Pendergrast and Matichuk.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, Mark Lee representing Ms. Pendergrast. I'd like to reserve 7 minutes for the to address the cross appeal and my rebuttal.
Okay.
And focus solely on the issue of troubling.
You just want 3 minutes to open.
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And focus solely on the issue of whether the trial court erred in failing to treble the $40,000 awarded in non-economic damages under the timber trespass statute, RCW 6412.030. Initially, I think it's important to recognize the standards and rules of interpretation that apply to a statute. And most importantly in this case are that courts must not read into the statute words that are not there, and the courts must not modify language within a statute. The pertinent statute here simply says, any judgment for the plaintiff shall be for treble the amount of damages claimed or assessed. The damages award in this case included economic and non-economic damages. Nonetheless, the trial court determined that in a literal and narrow interpretation of the statute, non-economic damages should not be included in the trebling obligation. The term damages simply is by itself in the statute. That is a clear and unambiguous term. It does not differentiate between the classes or category of damages that are awarded under the statute. In essence, the trial court included the word economic in the statute, had to have, in order to come to the interpretation that only economic damages would be trebled.
Okay, what do you make of the Supreme Court's feeling the need to include footnote 3 in the Birchler case?
That is a very interesting question, Your Honor, and I think
I just said nothing.
Well, the reason for the footnote was simply one of procedure. There are rules that must be followed in order to preserve an error.
It explains the result that you could write the Birchler opinion without ever mentioning what's in footnote 3 since it was only an oral argument, not in a brief.
That's true. But I think then it would be very unclear if it wasn't explained what the end result was on that case. And in that particular case, it was non-trebling of those damages because the issue was not preserved for appeal. Whereas here, it was preserved. It was argued. And in fact, there was no contrary argument by Mr. Matichuk. The trial court came to this decision on its own. And the Birchler case is absolutely controlling. And because the Birchler case at the Supreme Court level specifically identified that non-economic damages were a component of the damages awardable under the statute itself. When it becomes part of the damages under the statute itself, the trial court had no discretion but to treble the damages at that point. Unless there are any further questions, I have nothing more on that issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
See you in 10 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Brian Lane. I represent the defendants in the underlying case, Mr. Matichuk and his company, Blaine Properties, LLC. There's multiple issues here responding to his argument and also making my own. I'd prefer to start with my own, but I can take it either way you want to do it. It's fine.
You've got 9 minutes and 43 seconds to use however
you like. All right. Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, our appeal is about the error that was committed, in our opinion, by the trial court in granting summary judgment before the trial with regard to confirming as a matter of law that Ms. Pendergrast was entitled to this strip of land based on the boundary by common grantor theory. We think that that was error. Before the trial, the court made two rulings on summary judgment that, to me, are counterintuitive. The first was that they found that there was no meeting of the minds such that Ms. Pendergrast could prevail on her theory of boundary by agreement, but at the same time, he found that there was a meeting of the minds such that the court could award summary judgment to Ms. Pendergrast based on boundary by common.
Meetings of minds between different actors, boundary line by agreement would have to be between the parties to this litigation. There was no evidence of that. the common grantor doctrine would be a reference to a meeting of the minds between the common grantor and each buyer as a parcel was being sold to them, so that those would not be inconsistent.
I think that it is true that there could also be a boundary agreement between Ms. Pendergrast and Mr. Matichuk, that would be an initial thing. But I think here in this case, the only discussion was about whatever happened between the initial owner that sold both properties, Ms. Conine, and the buyers, Mr. Matichuk and Ms. Pendergrast.
That a seller who has a piece of improved property with a fence marking part of the property in some fashion, and somebody comes to buy the vacant lot that's on the far side of the fence, he paces it off, he discovers that the description of the deed is different than where he thinks the fence would be, he doesn't say anything to anybody, and he goes ahead and closes the sale. And you have someone else who responds to an ad that says it's fenced on, partially fenced, and goes out and looks at it, and there's our improvements and a yard on one side of the fence, and there's a vacant lot on the other side of the fence. Is there anything in that conduct that's inconsistent with the trial court's conclusion?
Yes, I think so. The whole ruling of the trial court is predicated on essentially Mr. Matichuk leaving the fence there for a certain period of time after he bought.
More than that, he didn't say anything or ask any questions when he paced it off, and the fence wasn't where it would be if he was buying the amount of land described in the deed.
He believed that what was in the deed is what he was buying.
Well, that's what he says was in a lawsuit 3 years later, but his behavior is a little bit inconsistent, isn't it, when he doesn't ask anything about what's this fence doing here if I'm really getting 100 and some feet?
I agree that he did not ask questions at that time.
Isn't that the time to ask questions about the boundary if it's different than what's clearly there to be seen by everybody?
Well, the general rule is the deed controls.
Well, not under the common grantor doctrine.
Well, that's an
exception.
It's a limited exception to that rule, yes.
Well, usually when we go out and look at something and it's pretty clear to everybody looking at it that that's what people think is the boundary, you're supposed to ask a question if you think the piece of paper describes something different, aren't you?
A prudent person would, yes. And in this case, that apparently didn't happen.
Well, more than apparently, your client doesn't claim it happened, does he?
No, he said he paced it. He was satisfied with his pacing. He thought he saw corner markers, and he proceeded with the transaction at that point. Yes. The whole basis of the common grantor doctrine is found in Fiala is this notion of a special relationship between the person that's establishing the boundary and the subsequent people that take the property. There's no such communication here or any kind of a relationship between these people at all. The deeds merely said were based on legal descriptions of the property. The buyers never met the seller, never had any conversations with the seller at all. And so really there isn't anything upon which any subsequent people would be able to determine that the fence had been the boundary.
You don't think if we took 12 people out and showed them a vacant lot, a fence, and yard on the other side and said, one guy owns all this, where do you think he thinks the common boundary is?
Well, first of all, it's not a complete fence. Second, it's not a straight line fence. It meanders.
To my question is.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If we took people out and there's unimproved property on one side of the fence and there's a yard on the other side of the fence and the same person owns both parcels and he's selling the vacant lot, what would most people think he was selling?
The vacant lot.
And where do you think they would think the common boundary was?
It's uncertain. Fiala held that a chain link fence that was there was not necessarily constructive notice of a change of a boundary. I don't think we can draw that conclusion.
Well, it appears that what we're missing are other facts that would more create that question. If he had rows and rows of wonderful roses and there was a fence that was designed to keep the deer out, that wouldn't necessarily be a fence that was put up to mark a boundary. If he was a horse owner and had fences put up to keep the deer in, or the horses in, that wouldn't necessarily be a boundary. But what explanation in the record is there for this fence other than being a boundary fence?
It's just a fence to for the people that owned a home to keep their children in or whatever. It does not follow a straight line. It goes out and around a tree. It isn't what you would expect to be a boundary along a property line. It didn't follow that direction. I really think that at most here there's an inference of an agreement or between Mr. Matichuk and the seller, and we're not. This was decided on summary judgment as a matter of law, and I don't think that the court should have just inferred this agreement between Mr. Matichuk and Ms. Conine, absent any discussions between them at all, absent anything in the written documentation at all, and absent anything other than just leaving the fence there for a short period of time after he purchased it. The plaintiff relies on Winans versus Ross for that the after sale conduct is what was important, but it's all inference. There's no discussion, there's no agreement, there's no negotiation, there's no nothing that satisfies.
You've only got about 2 minutes left.
I understand.
And there's another elephant.
I understand. And that has to do with trebling the damages on non-economic loss.
I don't get to write any words into the statute, such as actual or economic or something else. What rule lets us do that?
Well, I think that it's important that the legislature has never changed the statute at all since Birchler was decided. Birchler raises
it. Is that against you? Birchler says that this is a component of what's meant by the word damages in the statute. And the statute says you triple damages.
And it's also a penal statute that should be applied restrictively instead of expansive.
You have a penal case involving a penal statute that says that when the words are plain on their face, we can still do what we think is better because it's so punitive?
I don't think they're plain on their face. It just says damages. It doesn't say non-economic and economic, anything like that. It just says we treble damages
for
the timber loss.
All the damages unless there's an adjective in front of the word damages.
I think the only response I have to that.
You're asking us to read a modifier into the statute.
I'm asking you to interpret a 100-year-old statute when there wasn't even economic loss at the time that statute was written.
Well, the legislature has met a number of times since August of 1997, and they've never amended the statute to restrict its application after the Supreme Court told us what the word damages means.
Correct. They have not done it. It has not been changed at all since. But in the same token, Birchler didn't treble the damages either.
And they explained why as well. They didn't
get
asked to until oral argument.
Correct. And that may or may not mean that they would have. We don't know. But they just made that notation. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. As you pointed out, Judge Leach, I believe, the proof in the agreement comes from the parties' manifestations of ownership after the sale. And what greater manifestation of ownership could there be than to enclose your property? The fence at issue was a six-foot-high, fence that was fully filled in, that extended across the entire common boundary line, that was exclusively occupied by Ms. Conine and then Ms. Pendergrass for not a short period of time, but for 3 years.
Can we draw more than one inference from the fact that the fence didn't run in a straight line?
Well, the reason it didn't run in a straight line, it ran in a straight line until it got to a very large cherry tree that had
a
fort in it.
That, so you're not helping
yourself.
Why don't you just continue with your argument?
Well, yeah, Your Honor, it did run in a straight line until it reached a very large old cherry tree that had a fort in it, and it went around straight in a straight line, went straight out, and then continued straight beyond the cherry tree. So there was a reason for the the movement of the fence, and that was to encompass the cherry tree with a tree fort in it, which also was exclusively occupied and used by Ms. Conine and Ms. Pentecost for the three-year period of time. Not only that, the fence line, when it came in to one of the other corners of the common boundary, connected to a identical fence that then extended down Ms. Pentecost's property. So you do have an intersection where the fences are identical, and it completely encloses that area. So no, I do not believe you can gather any inference from the fact that it wasn't a straight line, because there is an explanation for why it's not straight. It was to allow this tree to continue to stay there and have its the tree fort in it. The other thing I think is interesting in the contentions by and this was at trial, and you picked this up too, Your Honor, the notion that there's some kind of inconsistency between the court's ruling, between the common grantor doctrine and the boundary by agreement doctrine. In essence, Mr. Matuszek and the defendants have to concede that there's no issue of fact because they prevailed on that issue at trial. And the elements of both claims are not mutually exclusive. The agreement, boundary by agreement, requires that there be a disagreement and a misunderstanding or a disagreement as to the two parties as to where the property line is. And in this particular case, there was never any opportunity for a disagreement. When Mr. Matuszek bought the property, he bought it subject to the fence line. And we do not know why the trial court granted summary judgment on that issue. So there's no conclusion inconsistency there. The other thing is the continued contention by the defendants that the lack of any conversation between the parties is somehow relevant. When we know from the Winans case that argument was specifically rejected, as was the argument that's being raised here again, that there's no reference to the fence in the legal descriptions. That would be completely inconsistent with the idea of the doctrine itself. Mr. Matuszek stepped off the boundary when he purchased the property. He testified in his deposition that he was unsure where the boundary line was at that time. He nonetheless went forward with the sale, allowed Ms. Conine to completely occupy up to the fence line, and allowed Ms. Pentecost to occupy up to the fence line for 3 years. At some point in time, he had a survey done, and even after the survey, months went by without him making any objection, allowing Ms. Pentecost to continue to occupy the property exclusively. Those manifestations, those actions clearly established, without a doubt, the doctrine, and summary judgment was appropriate. Unless you have any further questions on that, I don't know if you have any questions on the denial of the motion for a new trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.